My name is Richard Meisenheimer, and today is January 21st, 2003. I am interviewing Mr. Boyd K. Miller, known as B.K. Miller, at his home at 1035 Stadium in Alice, Texas, 78332. This interview is in support of the National Museum of the Pacific Wars, Center for Pacific War Studies, for the preservation of historical information related to World War II. Mr. Miller, I want to thank you for taking time to do this interview today.
Well, I think it's nice of you to take time to do all of it.
Let me ask you, where were you born?
In Houston, Texas.
And what is your birth date?
9/1/23.
Okay. And did you have brothers and sisters?
One brother and one sister.
Was your brother in World War II?
Yes, he was a pilot. And right at the beginning, I don't know what year, but he was taught aviation cadets, and they froze him and guys, you know, parallel with him to their jobs. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't join the Navy, Army, Air Force, or anything else. They had to stay there and teach.
Oh, it was a civilian doing that.
Civilian, mm-hmm. And the government contracted with civilian companies to do this primary training.
Okay. Now, is he older or younger than you?
He's 3 years older than I am.
Okay. And where did he do this training at?
He did most of it at Cuero, Texas.
Okay. And did he stay there the whole war then?
That's what I say. And most of it, I don't know that he, I believe he was there the whole war.
So he never actually got into the military then?
No.
Okay. Interesting.
Of a program that they called it. It was essentially military, but it wasn't actually military.
Right. Okay.
And that school was called Brayton Flying Service in Cuero.
Yeah, it was CPT, Civilian Pilot Training, was the program, right?
Well, no.
No.
That's where my brother got his training.
That's what I mean.
When he completed it, he went to work for this Brayton Flying School.
Oh, I see.
And taught Army, with Army Air Corps cadets.
Okay.
Primary flying training.
Okay. Where did you take your grammar schooling, high school schooling? Where did you take that?
Grammar school. And, well, all of it was in Houston, but Montrose Elementary School, and Sidney Lanier Junior High, and Mirabeau Lamar High School.
Okay. And what year did you graduate?
1940.
Okay. And then when did you go into the service?
In January of 43.
Okay. So what did you do from 1940 to 43 then?
I went to college.
Okay. And where did you go?
I went to the University of Houston.
Okay. And what were you studying?
I was an art major. I had won some scholarships in art, and it looked like it was a real easy field for me. And so that's what I started studying.
Okay. Now, when you went into the service, were you drafted or did you volunteer?
I was drafted.
In January of 43?
Right.
Do you remember what day?
January the 19th was the 19th. Swearing in. Okay. Pretty early in January.
Okay. And then you went into the Army.
Right.
And then did you, where did you take your training then? Where did you go from that?
Well, I went to Fort Sam Houston, and I don't remember what they call it, initial phase. Do you?
How long was
induction
it?
Center?
Oh, yeah, induction center, right.
And then they sent me to an assignment, was called Engineer Amphibian Command, and that was in Massachusetts. And so I was in that for quite a little while. It was Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and later Camp Edwards.
Did you take any basic training?
I took basic training at both, at Fort Devens and Camp Edwards.
This was infantry basic training or what?
It was infantry basic training.
Okay. About how long was that, do you recall?
No, I don't remember. Okay. Pretty long.
Okay. What did you live in there?
In barracks.
Barracks. So that was in January when you went up there. Was it pretty cold up there?
It was very cold. We got out of a truck in the middle of the night and snow up to our hips. And here this old South Texas boy, and wasn't really used to that.
Right.
But it was interesting.
And how was the food there?
The food was fine. I don't remember anything specific. Someplace along the line, I know we had pork chops 49 days in a row. And I thought I liked pork chops, but after that, you get to wondering.
That's right. How did you travel up to Massachusetts?
By train.
Was it a troop train or were you on a civilian train?
It was just a civilian train, and they had, I don't know, maybe there were separate cars for the military. I don't even know how many guys were sent. Not a whole lot.
Approximately how long did it take to get there?
I would guess something like 4 or 5 days.
Okay. Did you have a sleeper or were you in a chair or how did you?
No, just a regular chair.
Okay. And then no stopping along the way? I mean, as far as getting off or anything
no.
like that? No. So you arrive there with all that snow.
Yeah.
So there you took infantry basic, is that correct?
Right, but I also took training for this engineer amphibian command.
Okay.
They were activating what they call the 4th Amphibious Brigade, and I never did find out for sure what happened to 1, 2, and 3, but this was 4.
Okay.
And I worked in an office. I ran a transient barracks where they would get recruits just like I was. Mm-hmm. And you get one of those big barracks, you know, two-story kind, right. And they had double bunks, and I don't recall how many it held, but somewhere around 200. And when these recruits would come in, and I started out assisting a sergeant in processing the other recruits and issue special equipment. I had paratroop boots and different types of Mackinac, maybe something else, and set it out a little different than the other outfits in the Army.
Okay. Now this is while you were taking your basic infantry basic, or just after
right.
while you were doing it, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have to go on quite a bit of marching?
You bet. I know sometimes those night marches, I think we had buddies, and you know, you're supposed to stick close to the buddy, and they had the group divided into two parts, like A and B, or red and blue, or something,
right.
And some type of a military tactical thing where one group was supposed to try to outdo the other.
Right.
And I was walking with this buddy, and we were whispering because of, you know, the security.
Mm-hmm.
And I whispered something, and he didn't respond, and I turned around to look for him, and he wasn't there. Sure enough, he had fallen in a snow-filled foxhole.
Oh.
Kind of amusing.
Right. Anything else amusing happened while you were there?
Well, yeah, something real amusing. We had some people from the Signal Corps. They were fairly new in the service, but they had gone to signal school. There were about 5 of them. And one was a guy named Jimmy Licurto, who said that he was the radio actor that played the part of the shadow. And then from Houston, we'd hear it every now and then, but it wasn't just real regular. But one time I had a barracks full of the New York recruits, and that's the heart of the shadow country, and we had a typically ghosty night. It was stormy and power went out. There was snow and ice everywhere, and this barracks full of New York kids, that they were frightened anyway. And so I asked Jimmy, said, you know, I guess the most famous thing for the shadow was this laugh where it would start out high and go down low. And said, Jimmy, why don't, just for entertainment, the lights are out, and, you know, go out in the middle of the barracks and do the shadow laugh. And he said, I better not do that. So I finally talked him into it, and so he did it, and it was booming. And when I knew what was going on, and it scared me, and boy, these New York kids started running and stumbling, falling over those iron bunks, and... And the next day at sick call, when I had over half my barracks report and I had a lot of explaining to do. We were just playing games, sir.
Yeah, who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men, huh?
Yeah, and the shadow knows. But he told me how he developed that laugh that the director knew the certain sound that he wanted. And so Jimmy said he'd laugh into different types of containers, like boxes and buckets and various things. And they got the sound with an echo-like effect from this particular container that the director liked. So they taped it, and he practiced it to where he could do it real well without the aid of the bucket. And he did it real well that night.
Now, what did your amphibious training consist of there?
Well, I didn't really train in amphibious equipment, but I was there's a number for your occupancy.
MOS?
MOS, yeah. And mine was artist draftsman, since I'd been studying art. And okay. I did drafting, too, and for a next-door neighbor was an architect. And so anyway, I would do artwork and drafting for these training manuals that they used for the amphibious program. It was how to establish beachheads, and we had diagrams that show where you put the gasoline, where you put the food, and ammunition, and there were various types of craft that would come up, and the front would open up, and either the men would run out, or tanks, or something. And so there are different kind of, they call them dumps, you establish the dump for whatever type of equipment it was.
Okay, and that was what you drew the diagrams for, that or whatever.
Yeah, whatever artwork was needed. And there were, I think, four of us in this office that did that. It was kind of unusual. One was a captain, and one was a first lieutenant, and one was either a corporal or a sergeant, and I was just a buck private. And we all did the same work. I don't think we got the same pay.
Speaking of pay, do you recall what your pay was when you went in?
I sure don't. Seemed like $28, does that ring a bell?
Could be, right.
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Okay. And then this was at the same time you're taking your basic, you're doing this, is that correct?
Right. Okay. And then I went to Camp Edwards with the amphibian command. Oh, that Camp Edwards is where I worked on those training guides.
Oh, okay.
Not at Fort Devens. At Fort Devens, I was the sergeant's assistant to running this transient barracks.
Yes,
and then later, he went somewhere. Went in the hospital, really. And so I just ran the barracks by myself. Did his work and mine, too.
Okay.
In addition to your normal duties, you will do this, that, and the other. Isn't that what they said?
Yeah, right.
I went to Camp Edwards, and that's where I did the basic training again, and it was a little more intense, and there was a field associated with Camp Edwards called Otis Field, and I'd be marching along carrying that pack, and I'd M1 rifle, and I'd see these planes taking off and landing, and I said, those guys are, I guess they're in training pretty much the same as I am, but they're not walking. So I applied for transfer to the Air Corps. My brother, being a pilot, and a lot of my buddies signed up for the Air Corps to be pilots. And the reason I didn't go in earlier was that I was trying to complete the second year of college before I went into service. Mm-hmm. And so I finally managed to get the okay to take the series of tests to see if I qualified to go in the Air Corps or Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
And no, it was the Army Air Corps. And so eventually I got in, and it was kind of unusual. There was a adjutant general officer that would come by and check this place where I was working, because it was all, I don't remember the level of restrictions, but it was pretty classified. Mm-hmm. And this guy would check everybody out from time to time and just look around. And he's the one that signed the application for me to apply for this Air Corps training or transfer.
Right.
And one day when he was down at our area, and it had been, seems like several months, he said, "What in the world are you still doing here?" I said, "That's where I work." And he said, "Well, what about your transfer?" And I said, "Well, nothing ever happened." And he said, "We'll find out." And so we got in a vehicle and we went from station to station. It's a great big field. And we'll find out where it got pigeonholed. And sure enough, he found it.
Hmm.
He was a major, and he let some colonel have it.
Some colonel, huh?
Yeah, for pigeonholing that application. And so I did get the okay to take the test, and I passed the test and got in the Air Corps.
About when, what date was that? Do you recall the date when you transferred to the Air Corps?
No, sir. I might.
Okay, read it again.
Sworn in. Well, there's information on here.
Right.
It's really not very applicable. No, it doesn't have when I changed.
Okay. Had you been in about a year, do you think, or less or more?
Oh, no, less.
Less than a year, okay. So it's still been sometime in 43 then.
Yeah.
Okay. That's close enough. Okay.
I got an emergency furlough. Remember Richard? I got an emergency furlough for my mother's illness, and I was already in the Air Corps, but I wasn't doing anything. Was at Classification Center at Nashville.
At where?
Nashville.
Oh.
Then that's where you take these tests, and then you just lay around and wait. And I know it was real cold there, and they burned coal, and it was black snow.
That was in Nashville, Tennessee, huh?
Right.
Right. So you went from Camp Edwards down to Nashville, Tennessee?
Yeah.
Okay.
And took these tests, and that's where they would decide, you know, had applied to be in the flight program. And
okay.
You'd take these tests, and they would determine whether you're best suited to be a pilot, navigator, or bombardier, or none of the above. And then I think also in the pilot category, where it was single engine or multi engine.
Okay.
Everybody I knew wanted to be single engine, and that's what I got to be.
Okay, so you passed and went into pilot training for single engine then.
Well, yeah, I was signed up for it.
Okay.
They didn't have room in the schools at the time, and so we just got assigned to some other field, and they did things like, well, that gave me the okay to be in the cadet program.
Okay.
Pilot training.
Okay.
And so then I went to, I call it pre-flight, was it? Montgomery.
Yeah, ground school?
Yeah.
Okay.
And no flying involved at
right.
all there. Somewhere along the way, I went to a thing called CTD, which was a college training detachment.
Okay.
And I was sent to I'll think of it in a minute, but then Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And you had a series of college level courses in history and speaking, and then you also had 10 hours of flying or riding in
okay.
a cub to see if you were, you know, could be acclimated to flying, because
yeah.
some people just couldn't
yeah.
go up. And,
right. Now, when you transferred to the Air Corps, did you get a increase in rank or anything?
No.
No. Still private.
Well, it was aviation cadet. Okay. And it was just a change, but it was no essentially like a private.
Okay.
But somewhere I got to be a PFC when I was in the Engineering okay. Fitting Command.
Okay.
And as a result of that, in the basic training, and I took basic training again and with the Air Corps.
Okay.
But, you know, they had a system of cadet officers, and so guys with previous experience, like I was, like 6 months, 8 months, whatever it was, made me an old hand.
Yeah. Okay.
So I was always a cadet officer, and which meant really you do the work, and but you're one of the cadets, and then you're in between because
okay.
you had to help regulate the all the cadet program and could be sure everybody was where they were supposed to be, and
okay.
and it was just really kind of double duty.
Okay. So in Pennsylvania, then you took some this college courses. Were
yeah.
you at a college?
That was Lafayette College.
Okay.
At Easton, Pennsylvania.
Okay.
And went to, and it was, I guess, I don't know whether it's considered an Ivy League school or not, but it had a lot of ivy on big old stone buildings. And we lived in dormitories there. And it was just a real pleasant experience. There weren't any military bases around, and but there were a lot of girls. They would call the dorm, and there's a phone in the corridor outside of our room, and there were three guys in the room I was in, and one of them would answer the phone most of the time, and he would talk to these girls, and he'd line up a date, which I'm sure the girls were interested in, and he'd line them up for Saturday at noon or something like that, and said, "I'll meet you at the town square." And so they would be on the square itself, and he would be maneuvering around on the other side on the street, across the street, and he'd pick out the best looking one and then go over there and tell her who he was, and then leave the rest for us scrubs.
Yeah. I got it. Okay. So, and of course, there were still college students going there also, as well as you Air Force people, Air Corps people.
Yeah, but there was also some Navy boys going mm-hmm. there in some type of program. There were quite a few more of those than there were us.
And okay. And about how long were you there then?
It was about like 6 months or something like okay. that.
So you probably went there towards the end of 43 and then the middle of 44 or some such when you finished up there?
I think so. That'd probably be about right.
Okay.
And then, like I mentioned earlier, they didn't have room for all the cadets in the training program, mm-hmm. so they just found jobs for us, and they were supposed to be like in training where you'd learn a little bit about the airplanes, and most of it was like pulling chocks and filling gas tanks on planes and assisting mechanics.
Yeah.
And I guess one of the first actual flight that I went on besides a Cub was mm-hmm. with a Wasp, and they had some Wasps there would do engineering flights. Yeah. They would check planes after a wing change or something of that nature, and they would fly these prescribed maneuvers, and the crew chief or the mechanic for that particular plane had the right to join the test pilot on the flight. I guess it would just be proof that he had confidence in his work. So this mechanic that I worked with let me go on one of the flights, and this Wasp was really ringing the plane out, as they call it, and doing a lot of acrobatic maneuvers to see if she could get the wing to come off. It didn't.
And where was that at?
That was at
this is after you left Pennsylvania, is that correct?
Oh yeah.
So when you left Pennsylvania?
It was somewhere in Alabama, I guess.
So when you left Pennsylvania, you went to Alabama then?
I'm not real sure.
Okay.
I went to Mississippi for training. That's okay. Clarksville, Mississippi is where I took primary, but I don't recall where that was, I think it might have been Gulfport, Mississippi.
Okay. And the training at the primary, what did that consist of?
Well, that was your first flight training. So, and normally the training was three levels, is primary, basic, and advanced.
Okay.
And then you'd go half the day to ground school and the other half flying. Okay. Of course, you didn't fly the whole half day. The whole squadron flew, and it'd divide up the airplanes. And then you would have some instructor time to explain things to you. But this school was Clarksdale. Can't think of the name of it, but it was a school like where my brother taught at Cuero, and it had civilian instructors.
Okay.
And he would we flew PT-19s. And it was an upper class, lower class arrangement. And the upper class, when we were there, were flying PT-17s. That's a steerman.
Okay.
And we thought, well, that's what we're going to get. It's a bi-wing plane, and it was very maneuverable. But they changed with our class when we got there to the PT-19, which was a single wing. And very nice aircraft. It's Fairchild is what it was called. And then after the primary training, I went to basic training. And I mentioned that about the cadet officer stuff, because I was the cadet commander there, and the staff, the director of flying and the commandant of cadets and all, selected some people they thought should have this opportunity to go to Stuart Field for basic training. And Stuart Field is in New York, and that's where the West Point cadets flew, and they had really the very latest equipment and the nicest conditions. And they had steam heated brick barracks with hardwood floors, and somebody else did the polishing, which wasn't really the case in the normal program. We were really fortunate to get to go there.
Well, let's go back to your this primary training. This is where you took your first instruction flights.
Correct.
Okay. And did you solo when you were there?
Yeah, right.
Okay. About how long, how many hours did you have when you solo, you recall?
Well, I think it was about 8 hours of
dual instruction
flying before you solo.
Do you recall how it felt to solo the first time?
Oh, well,
I guess the solo was just a thing the first time, only one time.
Yeah, right. And so, you're the only one in there. You got to make it happen right.
Right. Okay.
But it was a real thrill, and you go through the prescribed maneuvers, and then come in and land. And I guess the landing was the trickiest part.
Right. Okay. So that's basically what you did there when you were at Clarksdale, is
right.
This primary training.
Yeah.
And then you transferred down to?
Well, that's where, then I went to the basic training in Stuart Field, New York. And
oh, okay.
That was the town was called Newburgh.
Okay.
And it was kind of odd. I was the guy that took the paperwork for the group of us that went there. I think there were 10 from our field. And reported in to the commandant of cadets, and I was ready to get put in a brace, you know, and all this yes sir, no sir, and have them chew you out for no reason. But this guy said, "Have a seat," and say, "You're here a little before the rest of the group is due, so it's actually the rest of a weekend, and if you'd like a TAC officer, he'll be glad to take you out to the skeet range." And I thought, when is the second shoe going to fall? But it never did. They were always real nice. And that skeet range, that was part of the training, too, where you'd shoot skeet, I guess, just to get
for
proficiency in shooting. And I really liked it. It had a card that had so many numbers around the edge, and he'd punch it, get punched every time he went to the range. And a lot of the guys didn't particularly care to go, and I would get their card punched for them. But I liked it.
Yeah.
So and after that, when we flew the latest, it was the first class of basic cadets to miss the basic trainer, the BT-13,
mm-hmm.
and we went directly into the AT-6, and it was a pilot type program, okay. or rather experimental, and to see if cadets that had completed basic training could go into the advanced trainer, and it worked out real well.
Okay, now, but you'd only finished primary, and so basic. What kind of planes you fly in basic?
That was the AT-6.
Okay,
it was the first class.
Straight from primary to
into advanced trainer, but it was basic training.
Oh, okay, I see.
And in basic training, it was just more of the same type of stuff, just as primary, only more advanced. And then they included navigation in the beginning, of radio work, and instrument flying.
How big a jump was it from the PT to the AT-6?
Well, I really didn't have anything to compare it to. It worked out just fine.
It wasn't a big problem to adapt.
No, apparently not, because they seemed to stick to that program after that, best I could tell.
The AT-6 retractable gear, whether the other one is not.
Yeah, that's one thing. And it was just more powerful. It was just a bigger plane.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was a radial engine, single wing.
Right.
And they use it a lot in these movies for
the Zero.
To resemble a Japanese Zero.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So then how long were you there?
Well, I think it lasts 4 months or maybe something in that neighborhood.
Okay. And you did cross countries, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I did a few. You had to do the navigation calculations and then fly them to see if they work.
Okay. Anything humorous to you happen along here anywhere?
Well, yeah. I don't know how long your tape is, but
I got plenty of tapes.
When I was in primary, I got a pleurisy, and pleurisy is an irritation in the lining of between the lung wall and the pleural cavity. And that skin tries to grow together, and then when you move, it pulls it. It really is painful. And so it caused me to be in this little medical facility for a while. And they said that if you did anything that was particularly strenuous or tiring until you got completely well, that thing would cut up. And so while I was in basic training, we had night flying, which was the first of that,
right.
as well as the navigation. And so we were flying at night, but that didn't change the day schedule, so you either had ground school or flying in the daytime. And so as a result of the added hours that made that pleurisy kick in, and so I was on one of these navigation flights. It was daytime, and it was a triangle-shaped thing. Mm-hmm. You navigate the first two legs, and then you're pretty close to out of gas, so you land and gas up, and then you fly that last leg back to the home field. And in that particular country, it was the geography was such that it was very simple, that last leg. It was in a valley of the mountains, and it was parallel to the Hudson River. And so that was just to get home. And so after I gassed up, after those first two legs, I got to where my pleurisy was hurting, and I was squirming around trying to get in a comfortable position. And I started listening to a commercial radio, but you really weren't supposed to do that, so I didn't do that very long. And So I finally found out that I didn't know where I was. Mm-hmm. And I started looking on the chart to try to match what was there with something on the ground, and I would see these different things, like landmarks, like football fields or some type of a racetrack or something that was be notable and where you could tell. And well, I couldn't seem to match anything, so I thought, well, I'll just fly straight east till I hit the Hudson River. It might be a long way, but that, you know, it's sure, and then I can just go north up the Hudson. And so I kept flying to just do 90 degrees, I finally saw that water, and gee whiz, that river is wide down here. And I never did see the other side, and it turned out I was too far south, and the Hudson had already emptied into the Atlantic, and I was just seeing the ocean. So I flew up the coast and found out where I was. I saw Sandy Hook, New Jersey, and I could recognize a lot of things. And mostly it was just a lot of buildings. And about then, I ran, my gas gauge started coughing or whatever, and says, you're out of gas again, boy, are you getting close? And they told us that there was some amount of gas left once this signal came on, and I couldn't remember if it meant two hours. I doubted that, because that's pretty long. So 2 minutes is not very long. And so I decided that I would just get out. And so I aimed the plane out toward the ocean, and I got at some altitude that I thought would be about right, and I got over the water enough and, you know, just eyeballed the wind to try to fall fairly close to shore so I could swim in. And I was really ready to go. I wasn't scared to jump at all. And I had the canopy back. And I got to thinking, it's going to be real embarrassing getting back home without that AT-6 I had strapped on me when I left. So I decided that there's bound to be some fields around there. So I decided I would land at the first field I saw, no matter what. And it was a Navy field where they manufactured these Hellcats across the highway, and they'd bring them over this field to test fly them. And this was a Saturday afternoon, so there wasn't a lot of traffic. And so I landed there, and these Navy boys said, what's going on? And I said, well, I got lost, and decided to pay you a visit. And he said, well, I'm out of gas, too. I said, oh, well, we can gas you up, and you know where you are now, right? I said, yeah, you bet. And I said, well, who's going to sign the ticket? And he said, you are. And I said, no, I can't do that. That's a big no-no. So I had to call in the home base. And I could hear them when I was flying. I could hear guys calling in for landing instruction. But they couldn't hear me when I would transmit. Mm-hmm. And I was really pretty much desperately calling in for some kind of instruction. And so the CO said, when I phoned the home base and told them what had happened, he said, well, you just stay there till somebody comes after you. I said, well, I know where I am. It's just a matter of this gas. You just stay there. So I waited, and there were two instructors left at our squadron shack, and the CO caught them, and they were sitting there planning a squirrel hunting trip for that afternoon instead of cadet hunting, so they had to come get me. And they didn't even chew me out and say, you Miller? Yes, sir. Get in the back. And they wouldn't even let me fly my own plane back. And that was kind of unusual. A couple of weeks after that, they called us all out in the formation, and we lined up out in front of the flight shack instead of normally in the back, and they had real brass out there, and you know, the director of flying, and real formal occasion, and this whack that checked the planes in and out. Said, when I landed, I was on the last flight of the morning, she said, you better hurry up and get in formation. Some big doings out there. And so I ran and got in formation, and they called me front and center. Wow, what's this? So this major pulled out a scroll like they do in military fashion, and in mine he said that I showed extraordinary heroism in landing in an enemy field, you know, the Navy. And I was awarded a fur-lined plastic pot, you know, a little pot like Kitch's. And there were a group of us, like six or seven, that had done some kind of goof-up and were awarded these things. And we had to wear them on this string around our neck, everything except PE and flying and sleeping. But every place else, you were on public display. And so the other guys, of course, they'd ride us pretty heavy. And the ones that were wearing the pots that, you know, that balked at that, and that's the ones they really got. But I kind of got a kick out of it, and so I guess they didn't pressure me too much, but it was kind of funny having to wear that. And after a while, there was another group that had fouled up, so they took our pots and awarded them to these other guys. The guy that got my pot was flying someplace, and he got lost. But he saw one of our planes that was flying the same heading, so he said, hey, I must be okay. He's going there, and I'm going. But it turned out that the guy whose heading he was flying was lost also, and he was flying this guy's heading. And so they landed, and they did worse than I did. This one guy pulled up his wheels instead of his
flaps,
and it sheared that prop off, and so he was in a little more trouble. And so he was wearing his pot down the flight line where the base commander came by, and he was a West Point bird colonel, and he saw that, and he asked that director of flying, what's going on with that kid? So he called him over there and said, son, tell the colonel why you're wearing that. So, well, got lost, pulled up my wheels instead of my flaps. And said, oh, man, that's pretty bad. But said, ask the major if he's ever landed wheels up. And that major popped to attention. I said, yes, sir. Said, son, you think that I've ever done that? He said, I have no idea. Have you, sir? And he said, yeah, but these chickens up here help me out. So that was kind of an amusing thing that happened there. It wasn't amusing at the time.
No. When you got back, did they chew you out much then or anything? Or what did they
no.
say?
No. The CO is our head, the commandant of cadets. I guess they're ruled. He couldn't leave till all the cadets are in, and he and his wife had some social thing planned, and she was all dressed up, and she was there, and she was pacing up and down more than he was. And so he said, I can't just let you get away with this. So over the remainder of the weekend, you write a 2,000-word theme on basic navigation. So you know what I did. And there was no follow-up. It was just, I guess, considered part of the game.
It's one of those things that happened, huh?
Yeah. Right.
Okay. Then, now this is there in Pennsylvania.
No, this was in Newburgh, New York.
Oh, you're back up there.
That's where it's basic training, Stuart Field.
Oh, okay.
That's the one where the West Point guys fly.
Yeah.
They fly in the good time of the year, and we were there in the winter time because we were regular cadets and we were expendable. When I reported in and at the next base, I took the paperwork, and that was in Spencefield, Moultrie, Georgia. That's where it took advanced training, and so I reported to the CO and turned the papers on all of our group in, and he saw that we were from Stuart Field, and he kind of blinked and said, well, are we to treat you as regular cadets? Because he knew that's West Point guys. And I said, well, I'm sure that'll be all right. So they did, you know, back to the grindstone.
Now let me ask you, so far, has there been any crashes, people been killed or anything?
Well, there were some. There was one at, I know there was one at Stewart Field. The guy didn't get killed, but that's where we started night flying. And this guy did just real great up until then, but he couldn't seem to understand how far down the ground was, because they had a big bank of light shining down the runway. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And it had dust particles in the air, and this guy would land on the dust, which was 10 or 12 feet, maybe more, yeah, in the air. And you'd stall out that, yeah, AT-6, and it would drop, wow, but you're supposed to do it pretty close to the ground.
Right.
And he tore up some planes doing that, but I don't think he got hurt. But there was one place, when we first went to Stewart Field, and they were taking us around, showing us the whole base, and we went through this one hangar, and there was an AT-6 wing that was about a foot and a half or 2 feet wide at the root, and they're normally 6 feet or 8 feet. And said that these two West Point cadets were flying on what they call a buddy ride, the two cadets and no instructor. Mm. And they put the plane in a dive, and they were playing chicken. And the one that pulled out was chicken, and neither one of them were chicken. And they'd pile it into the ground and to crunch that wing, and I think they showed us that to let us know that that it was pretty serious stuff.
Did it kill the man, I'm just thinking?
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. We didn't see it, but, yeah, you know, just saw the wing.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Then, after you left New York, you went to where, I'm sorry?
That was at Georgia, Spence Field.
Okay.
And that's for advanced training. And that we flew the AT-6 in advance. Of course,
again,
I was already familiar with it. And so it was just more intense training, more navigation, and all of that. Okay. And so then that's where I graduated from the cadet program. And following that is when you go to the